This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the U.S. Supreme Court declines to hear the North Carolina voter ID case, and both sides find hope in that. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board is deep in the weeds with the student assignment plan, considering changes before a vote next week. Local lawmakers comment on the ongoing turmoil at the White House over the firing of FBI Director James Comey, possible evidence of obstruction of justice, and the president's sharing of classified information with the Russians. The Raise the Age law passes the North Carolina House, moving the state one step closer to being in step with the other 50 states. And Governor Cooper promises LGBT protections. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from our WFAE newsroom. Good morning.
Good to be with you.
And Doss Helms is education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Sean Flynn is managing editor of Spectrum News Charlotte. Long time no see. Good to see you again.
Great to be back.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks at WFAE.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Last night, the three Democratic mayoral candidates got together for a debate and went back and forth over several topics, including the Keith Scott shooting and the city's now repealed anti-discrimination ordinance. It was sponsored by the Black Political Caucus, which plans to endorse one of those three by the weekend. How would you sum it up, Tom?
I would sum it up as odd for this simple reason. First of all, the reason that there were only Democrats on stage for this debate was because only the Democrats will have a primary race, it seems. Now, filing for these positions to file for a candidate, the filing period doesn't even open for, what is it, close to two or just about 2 months. Mm-hmm. So there are chances for other people to get in the race. But to have this debate now seems pretty clear. The Black Political Caucus is going to endorse on Sunday, again, long before the filing period has even hit. And it seems like this is part of the entire narrative that we've heard publicly talked about by two of the candidates, Vi Lyles and Joel Ford, that one of them, they're both African-American, that one of them may need to step aside in order to ensure that the other has a better chance of beating current mayor Jennifer Roberts, who's running for re-election. And this early endorsement seems to play into that, that it could be that this group helps decide the mind of either Joel Ford or Vi Lyles, that they will step aside and allow the other one to be the sole African-American candidate running for mayor.
Before this debate even began, there was a kerfuffle over whether or not Mayor Roberts would appear, and she did appear, although she had a prior commitment and had to leave early, but she did appear. Does she have a shot in getting that endorsement at all, Glenn?
I don't think she does. Let's be honest, I think the leader of the Congressional Black Caucus, or I'm sorry, the
Charlotte-Mecklenburg
Black Caucus. She's not a Roberts fan, and I think that's become pretty clear. Mm-hmm. I don't think she has a ghost of a chance of getting that nomination.
Yeah. We have a couple of clips of some of the things that were said by the three candidates, beginning with Jennifer Roberts, moving to Vi Lyles, and then on to Senator Joel Ford.
We have challenges. We have two Charlottes. We know that the opportunity that we're working so hard to create is not reaching every corner of our city. And we've had stresses in the community that have shown us that. And so I want to keep serving as mayor and working with all of you to help us bridge those gaps.
Good paying jobs, quality neighborhoods with affordable housing, a transportation system where a mother doesn't have to take 2 hours to commute to work and home. So a mayor that's strong, collaborative, and experienced.
I don't have the most experience in local government, and I don't think that that's important right now. But what I do believe is important is someone with a vision, someone with integrity, someone who can hold City Hall accountable for what they're doing on behalf of our community.
State Senator Joel Ford, City Councilperson Vi Lyles, who's the mayor pro tem, and also the mayor of Charlotte right now, Jennifer Roberts, at last night's debate. Roberts told, I guess there were nearly 200 people there at Reed Memorial Baptist Church, that she was the first elected official to call for the release of video in the shooting of Keith Scott. And she also called for a repeal of a new state law that is about to go into effect that would require the court's permission to release that video, and Joel Ford supported the law. Is that a bone of contention among voters?
I think it has the potential to be, especially in the African-American community. I've talked to a number of people who, especially when that vote first took place, who questioned Ford's decision to support and vote for that law. So I think as this campaign moves ahead, if he is the nominee, or perhaps even before that, that will become an issue, I suspect.
He said, Joel Ford said, that HB 972, which is that law, is not perfect, but it does provide a pathway for police video to be released. Wasn't that pathway already in place? Did we not have a way to get to that video prior to this law?
That was the first law, and actually what that did, it dealt more with the families of people involved. This law is contentious, though, because it specifically states that civilian review boards and elected officials cannot get this video unless they obtain a court order to
right.
do so.
Doesn't this law make it more difficult to get access to this video?
Well, the way he described it to me was that what this law does is that it standardizes it statewide. So instead of each having having this myriad of ways before that people could get these police videos, now there is a way statewide, and everyone understands the process for getting these videos released.
And also that decision is then taken out of the hands of the police department. It's then given to the authority of a judge who then makes that decision.
I will say it seems, I think a lot of us were suspicious that this was a way to keep video away from the public, but it actually seems like we've seen more videos released recently, whether that's
including
the increased awareness, right, that media outlets and lawyers and family members know how to do it now, okay. and that judges are maybe more willing to issue those orders. We have been seeing.
Yeah, but part of that is also the fact that both state laws that we're talking about give police departments the right to release this video if there is a deemed public need. Mm. What is interesting here, though, is this law, and you know, Joel Ford has been very forthright in the fact that he is a proponent of the law. It, again, specifically bars the release to civilian review boards, who their job is to look at these kind of police incidents, and elected officials, because the lawmakers were afraid of leaks. So it's not just about standardizing. I mean, let's face it, this new system when it comes to access to police videos is new, and the state is figuring it out. It's a complicated mess, so this does at least lay out the groundwork. But that, just because it standardizes it, does not mean that it makes it easier or a clear path, specifically with the General Assembly, who stated openly in debate that they don't trust elected officials with these tapes. So that is something, I think, Glenn, you're absolutely right. This is something that will continue in the election.
Immigration also came up last night, because there's this desire to protect immigrants on the part of some people in the city, and the fact that there's a state law saying there will be no sanctuary cities or there will be consequences. And the 287G program came up. That is the program that allows the sheriff's department here to detain for ICE, I guess, people who are here with no documentation. And Roberts, Mayor Roberts, had voted for that program. But today she says, we live in a different time. We brought people here to work. Now what do? Arrest them or figure it out? And Joel Ford said, we need to provide protection for immigrant families, but we need to make sure that we are in compliance with state law. He seems to be coming to this from a state representative's point of view, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think that's kind of been his pitch, is that I am somebody who is a Democrat but who knows how to work with these people in Raleigh that are primarily Republicans. He is a little more moderate, viewed as a little more moderate. I think that's going to be his pitch, is that a lot of this conflict between Raleigh and Charlotte maybe could have been avoided by somebody who was a little more savvy, who didn't. You know, he talked about that in connection with the ordinance that led to HB2 as well, that, you know, if they'd listened to us, if they'd even come to the delegation, we could have told them, if you'd backed off on this one thing, on this bathroom provision.
But you have to put the quarter in the jar now, because you mentioned it first.
Oh, no.
HB2. I think Sean wanted to chime in on it.
No, I was just going to say, this is actually fascinating to me, because as a person who's moderated many of the League of Women Voters debates for these local municipal races for the past decade, there's nothing that drives me more crazy than a primary debate where the candidates are saying the exact same thing. I actually remember one race where one candidate answer the question and his opponent said, amen, I agree with everything he said. So it is exciting to me to have two different, I mean, yes, you have Jennifer Roberts and Vi Lyles who are very similar and theirs is the difference on the leadership style, but you have Joel Ford coming at a different angle and you definitely have a lot of differences in these candidates. I think that's going to energize this campaign if it needed any more energy.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, I was also going to add though, let's not forget what this, I mean, the comment that you bring up with Vi Lyles, you know, kind of attack on Jennifer Roberts about her vote in favor of the 287G program. It's not really about Joel Ford. The immigrant community, the Hispanic and Latino community in Charlotte has been up in arms in what they see as a Charlotte City Council and a mayor right. that is not doing anything, symbolic or otherwise, to protect their interests. I think that comment is targeted to them to try to sway them in the primary to pick someone other than the incumbent mayor.
And another fissure appeared last night when they were talking about HB2. Mayor Roberts
had to quarter in the jar.
Thank you. Mayor Roberts had to leave before this discussion began. So this was between Joel Ford and Vi Lyles. And Ford said the city should have been taken a more cautious approach before guaranteeing rights for the LGBT community. He said we need to do it in a step-by-step process, to which Vi Lyles said, would you feel comfortable today if they told you to take a step-by-step approach to black people? Wow.
Yeah, it's a powerful line.
It really is. Ford is a very interesting candidate, in my opinion. I think you're absolutely right. He's the wild card in this race, really, in the Democratic part of it, at least. I just wonder if he's too centrist for Charlotte. We don't see African-American candidates in Charlotte who take positions that he's taken all that often. And I think he might be too much of a moderate for a city that is clearly liberal-leaning.
And the way he counters that, and I think you raise a really interesting point, is he has played the card of, well, guess what? I know how Raleigh works. I have a good relationship with the Republican-controlled General Assembly. Being a moderate, I can bridge the gap. The Great War may, you know, stop being a hot war and settle down to something of a cold war between Charlotte and Raleigh. And that's something where I'm curious to see if it resonates with Charlotte voters, given the HB2, given everything that has been going on between the city and the General Assembly now for years, or if it's a bit too esoteric to really stick in someone's mind when it comes time to go to the ballot box.
Exactly.
So the Black Political Caucus will decide on Sunday which of these three candidates they will endorse. It will probably come down to Vi Lyles or Senator Joel Ford. Will that cause one or the other to drop out of the race going forward?
It's possible. I mean, as I said earlier, it's one of the more interesting twists when it comes to this mayoral race. And to be clear, there's nothing, you know, everything they're talking about, perfectly legal, perfectly fine. Shoot, they haven't even filed to become official candidates yet, and they won't for quite some time. And a primary isn't even until September. But with they're openly talking about the possibility. And this is actually, there's precedent for this in terms of what led to Jennifer Roberts being elected mayor in the first place. Let's not forget that when she first ran in the primary, she was running against two African-American members of the Charlotte City Council. And she won 8, I believe, precincts, predominantly African-American precincts. The two other candidates, Michael Barnes and David Howard, split, in essence, the African-American vote, and that allowed Roberts to win.
When we come back, Supreme Court and voter IDs on the list of topics, and also the big gang arrest that was the gangs that were rounded up and arrested overnight last night, or the night before last. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Miles McClellan Construction, dedicated to meeting each of their clients' needs when it comes to project performance and its technical requirements. More info about Miles McClellan's approach at mmbuildings.com. And O2 EMC, an independent power producer that develops, owns, and operates solar farms, working with institutional investors and banks to bring clean energy generation to rural communities. O2EMC.com. Every day, head-spinning news whirls out of the Trump White House, especially since the firing of FBI Director James Comey. Since that event, we've heard comparisons to Watergate, rumblings of impeachment, and listened to the president characterize all of this as an unprecedented witch hunt. But is it any of those things? We get the opinions of a few political scientists and one former Charlotte City Council member who had a front row seat to Watergate when Charlotte talks on this program Monday at 9.
I'm Tom Gelton. Coming up on the next On Point, bombshell week in Washington, classified information shared with Russia, special counsel appointed, Roger Ailes. The president heads off on his first foreign trip. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point coming up at 10, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins, QCityMetro.com, and Sean Flynn, managing editor of Spectrum News Charlotte. The FBI conducted a gang takedown operation this week in Charlotte and other cities around the country, mostly on the East Coast. How many did they nab, and why the push now? Who wants to talk about that?
I believe they got 83 people altogether, had 600 law enforcement officers fanned out across several states. This is an investigation into the United Blood Nation that's been going on for a number of years. We've seen some other arrests. We've seen some violence from this gang. So the kind of this multi-state sweep, a lot of people in Charlotte, a lot of people, oddly, in Shelby and Cleveland County seem to be kind
people.
Of a hotbed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is the biggest crackdown, the largest crackdown of street gangs in Charlotte ever.
Ever.
Yep.
In the history.
What's driving this right now? Is this the new Justice Department?
You'll remember about a month ago, the Attorney General came out and point blank said, we're going after the gangs. And he specifically mentioned MS-13. And I remember doing a couple stories about, obviously, we have some MS-13 issues here as well. So I don't think this comes as a surprise to most people that they targeted it. I think the sheer number and then just the vast reach of this. I mean, you're talking, they didn't really have to go out and arrest because some of the gang members were in prison. Coordinating.
In fact, run by people
right,
in prison. Yeah.
This was being run by people in New York prison. So the vast reach of this is coming down from the Attorney General and their mission on to target gang members.
So was this for specific acts of violence and crimes, or was this just for gangs?
This was you name it.
I mean, yeah, it was really a catch-all.
They hit everything. I mean, they threw – I mean, I think there was a jaywalking – no, there wasn't. But, I mean, seriously, they were going after all the white-collar crimes. This had six murders. Now, remember, just a couple of weeks ago, this was one where a couple of these same UBN members admitted guilt, were sentenced to, killing the couple down in Fort Mill in York County, right. Who were witnesses in one of their crimes. I mean, this is a violent gang that was targeting witnesses, and obviously something that you don't want around here.
Tom, I
wondered about the timing as well. Donald Trump and his administration has been in office for 5 months. Clearly, this investigation has been going on a lot longer than that. What I did notice was that. There was a concerted effort to make this appear to be an initiative of the Trump administration, and I'm sure maybe that hastened the timetable. Mm-hmm. But this effort clearly is more than 5 months old. You don't pull off this kind of thing in 5 months.
And in fact, the U.S. attorney here in Charlotte credited the Trump administration's push as why this happened now. But you're absolutely right. I mean, this is the kind of – I mean, I believe in the same press conference she said that they'd been working on this for 2 to 3 years.
But she also credited a new thrust from the new administration. It's U.S. Attorney Jill Westmoreland Rose putting people on notice who are involved in criminal activity.
For other criminal organizations and gangs like the UBN, other street gangs who are terrorizing our communities, take note. We are now – under this new administration, unleashing all the laws at our disposal to disrupt and dismantle criminal organizations.
Tom.
Well, what's interesting here, besides the murder and the drug charges and the smuggling of contraband cell phones into prisons, and these are all things that you'll find in the charge sheet, you know, Sean brought this up, and I think it's worth exploring. They charge these gang members not just with your classic kind of gang violent crime. They talked about stolen credit cards, identity theft, bank fraud. They talked about, you know, more of this kind of white collar stuff that you hadn't really seen gangs do in the past, but clearly they're expanding into. And the charge sheet was so broad that as you're going through the 83 names, you'll even see references to paying dues to the gang as a reason that they were charged. And they did this basically under part of this, at least clearly under the racketeering aspect of federal law. So this is a very big sweep. And it did center specifically in the Carolinas, even though they said it went from New York down to Florida. This was the hotbed.
Glenn. Well,
what's interesting to me, and maybe it's just me and I live a sheltered life, is how isolated I personally feel from all this. When you start talking about Charlotte as a hotbed of gang activity and all that kind of stuff, I don't think our typical listener actually understands that or feels that in his or her day-to-day life. So I wonder if there are parts of the city that do feel besieged by this gang activity and this violence.
And,
but I don't think most of us feel it.
Yeah, I think that this is part of the delicate balance that we're seeing, too. I think that you're going to see civil rights groups and people who will be watching this with some concern when you have an administration that came in on a law and order and control this American carnage. You know, those inner cities are so horrible. And then you see vanloads of, of black people being swept off to jail. Who is not in favor of bringing in violent gangs? Mm. But I think people are going to be watching to make sure that this doesn't become sort of part of the let's sweep up everybody, let's control.
And the new war on drugs, which impacts black people inordinately.
And the people who may feel under siege from the gangs may be in some ways the same neighborhoods that often feel under siege from the police.
Sean?
And adding on to what Glenn was saying, I think a lot of us don't really realize that there are significant gang issues. Now, if you live in like the Hidden Valley neighborhood, you get it. You've been living it for a long time. But again, going back to what the charges that they were talking about, this is no longer gang member on gang member crime. They are targeting other members of the community. They're expanding their reach. They're targeting innocent civilians for the money laundering, the identity theft. And when you start going into these armed robberies and then you're killing off witnesses, this goes well beyond gang on gang crime.
Well, changing the subject a little bit, but still staying with the courts and laws and things like that. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal on a lower court ruling striking down North Carolina's voter ID law. We did a whole hour on this. Tom, you were here, so tell us again why they did this.
Procedural moves. I mean, this really is the Supreme Court of the United States punting on this issue. And this procedural moves, it's actually kind of interesting. So just as a refresher, you know, in 2013, the General Assembly passed a very wide-ranging election law change, signed into law by then-Governor Pat McCrory. It included voter ID provisions, shortening early voting periods, ending same-day registration and vote, and out-of-precinct voting. A lot was in this bill. It was taken to court. The first district judge basically put out a 500-page ruling that said, hey, all of this is perfectly legal and fine. It was then appealed to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and a three-judge panel there said, not so fast. The judge in the district level kind of missed the forest for the trees. And everybody was waiting to see what the Supreme Court would do. This is a classic, or it appeared to be a classic, trademark lawsuit that would set national precedent. But in the intervening time between these lawsuits and the appeal that was filed to the U.S. Supreme Court, you have a change in governor and a change in attorney general. Now Democratic Governor Roy Cooper wants to pull and asked to pull the state's appeal, which would let the Fourth Circuit's ruling stand. The North Carolina attorney general agreed. He is also Democrat, Josh Stein. The General Assembly leaders said, hang on a second, we want this to go forward. So in his decision, Chief Justice Roberts said, with all this blizzard of filings, as I believe how he stated it, we don't know exactly who has standing to bring this issue to the court, so we are not going to take up this issue. But he also pointed out that is not because of the merits on either side of the case.
And both of sides reacted favorably to the fact that the Supreme Court did not hear the appeal. First, we hear from Attorney General Josh Stein.
We should ensure that only eligible people vote. But we cannot erect barriers that make it harder for eligible people to vote. if they try to bring forward the same type of proposal that's going to have a discriminatory impact on different groups of voters, it too will be struck down.
And here's State Republican Party Chairman Robin Hayes.
Chief Justice Roberts made it very clear that his ruling today was really not about the case itself. In other words, he is not in any way saying that North Carolina is incorrect in their continued efforts to establish a responsible voter ID program.
And in fact, we talked about this on Tuesday, I think it was, Tom, that the fact that the Chief Justice Roberts said, hey, we're not turning this down on the merits of the case, sent a very loud signal to lawmakers.
Well, they interpreted that signal in their own specific way. As you pointed out, both sides here did. But to be clear, the fact that the Supreme Court did not take up this appeal means the Fourth Circuit's ruling stands. So that law is not in effect.
Right.
But even Governor Kupner described it as a temporary win and said that he was thought that within 10 days we'd be seeing some kind of action from the General Assembly to follow up on this.
On our hour on this on Tuesday, State Republican Senator Jeff Tart joined us briefly, and he reiterated the need, what he saw as the need, to enact a measure requiring people to show a photo ID at the polls, and that anything more would need to be carefully considered. So is he saying what we need here is voter ID, but we don't need all the other stuff that came attached to the law that was struck down?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Do you have broad support for that, or are Republicans going to be looking for ways to bring back the other things in ways that might pass muster with
I think
the
they will definitely be looking for ways to bring back the other thing. You asked one of your guests earlier this week if this was a matter of race or politics. It's definitely a matter of politics, but it's also a matter of demographics. And I've said this before. Our nation is changing. Our national demographics are changing. We're becoming a browner nation,
right,
and our voting patterns are shifting. Look no farther than the fact that the Democrats have won 6 out of the last 7 presidential elections, if you count the popular vote. So the Republicans are in a bind. Unless they figure out a way to incorporate some of these black, brown voters who are coming on or suppress their vote, they're in a bind. And in my opinion, so far they've chosen the latter. They've chosen to figure out how to suppress that vote through gerrymandering, through voter ID, through other voter suppression measures, rather than having a true outreach.
But is that political or is that racial?
I think it's political at the end of the day, but it's hard to separate politics and race in America.
Right.
They're kind of one in the same. But at the end of the day, it's about politics. I don't think it's necessarily done out of animus toward African Americans. I think if African Americans were voting Republican, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
And I think the best way to kind of put a punctuation mark on what you just said there, Glenn, is going back to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which found that this is, in fact, both political and racial, and they ruled that this law targeted African-American voters with almost surgical precision. Predominantly, not always, they're not a solid voting block, but the predominant African-American voter is going to vote Democrat.
And when you target African-American voters, you're in effect targeting Democrats.
Okay. The school board is combing through Superintendent Ann Clark's assignment plan, and as they did, they discovered the price tag, $12.6 million over the next 2 years, not including the cost for buses. Was that unanticipated? Is that average for these assignment plans that come out every 6 years or so?
Yeah, and I think, it's always kind of, if you're used to the budgets that most of us are used to personally, these numbers sound huge when you're thinking of it in the context of a $1.4 billion operating budget. Ann Clark is kind of saying, oh, yeah, we got most of this worked into next year's budget, even though actually next year's budget is not approved yet. But evidently they're not sweating it. And some of it, the biggest chunk is $5.4 million to renovate and reopen the Williams Middle School. They're saying we've got a couple of properties, the old Ed Center uptown and the place in Davidson. I'm drawing a blank on the name of it. But we're going to sell a couple of our properties. This cash will come in. We'll use that to renovate the Wilson Middle School. A lot of it is curriculum type things, training teachers, getting the technology in place. A lot of these magnets are STEM magnets, science, technology, engineering, and math. They're saying we've got career technical education money coming in. We will use that for some of these programs. So she's saying, sure, there's a cost, but don't sweat it.
And you reported on the meeting that was held this week, and at which you say it was hoped that a clear outline of the pros and cons of the plan would emerge, but instead we got what you described as 3 hours of vague discussion. What does that mean?
Well, it was interesting to be there because not only has the school board been poring over this, but since Ann Clark released her proposals, you've had numerous neighborhood and school-based groups that have been really poring through the data and coming up with alternative proposals and lobbying hard, going to these community meetings, presenting these plans, lobbying their school board. And I think what a lot of us literally during this meeting, you know, we were tweeting back and forth and exchanging messages with some of the parents who were interested, and everybody thought it would be, okay, here is the Myers Park neighborhood school proposal. We either do or don't support it, and here are the reasons. It would have these effects, good and bad. Here is the two great middle schools proposal. Here's our analysis of it. Here's why we do or don't support it.
Right.
And in fact, we got a lot of these are tied to the Dilworth-Sedgefield pairing of elementary schools. And you got these bullet points that people were trying to figure out what they meant. Things like add a third elementary school to the combined attendance boundary. What? Which one? What does that mean? Are we now talking about moving among three? Literally, WFA's Lisa Wharf and I, at the end of this meeting, were waiting for Ann Clark to conclude a conversation with someone else so we could ask her some of these things. And we were looking at each other and going, what do you think this means? Is this Myers Park traditional? Is this something else?
Well, Lisa reported earlier this week that despite a series of meetings that they've been holding, the school board's been holding with parents to listen to parents, not a lot of changes to the plan were announced in advance, and that the proposal's most controversial parts remain intact, including the plan to split the Moorhead STEM K-8 school into three schools, becoming all partial magnets. That surprised anybody? Disappoint anyone?
Well, I think what it means is that we're going into next Wednesday's meeting, and it is Wednesday rather than regular Tuesday, so if you show up with your signs on Tuesday, you'll be disappointed. But Wednesday there will be a public hearing and there will be a vote, so either they're going to have a straight yes or no vote on everything that's exactly or more or less as Ann Clark proposed it,
right,
or there will be some alternatives introduced which people will not have had a lot of time to see.
And you say this leaves two troubling prospects looming for this next Wednesday meeting when the vote is planned. One is that you see a fairly serious split, mostly along racial lines. Is this over the pairing of schools or other aspects of the plan?
Well, it is related to the whole how much all of this always comes down to who is perceived as winning and who is perceived as losing. And I think there is a feeling in certainly large parts of the black community that their voices tend to go unheard, whereas the more affluent and more white neighborhoods get a better hearing. And I think Moorhead has kind of become symbolic of this. Moorhead is a majority black, fairly high poverty magnet school that's doing extremely well. There were a lot of families that came out and spoke against this, spoke sometimes in some strong and questionable language in terms of the way they depicted students at the neighborhood schools. But you had Rhonda Lennon, for instance, who represents the North Suburbs, who made a very strong statement at this meeting saying, basically, we're okay with this overall plan, we're supporting it, but boy, this Moorhead thing, you know, I don't like having people threaten to leave. And Ruby Jones then, who is a black board member, took some real exception to the way she phrased this, and it's probably more complicated than we can
We'll come back to it because a lot of this has to do with these school pairings, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more about that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and South State Bank, committed to bridging the gap between a big bank and a small one, offering commercial banking, private banking, and wealth management. Details at southstatebank.com. And the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, presenting Beckler's ensemble with music and dance choreography, celebrating Jean Tanguy's 50th anniversary, Sunday, May 21st. Details at beckler.org. President Trump heads off on his first foreign trip in office, leaving behind a string of bombshell developments in the investigation into Russia and last year's election. A recap of a week of nonstop news in Washington, including the appointment of a special counsel, all being discussed in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock during On Point. Guest host Tom Jelton hosts their national news hour, which will include news of the death of former Fox News titan Roger Ailes. That's all upcoming. You can join our conversation at Twitter at Charlotte Talks using the hashtag WFAE Roundup, or email us, charlottetalks@wfae.org. Animals and entertainment go way back. So with Ringling Brothers Circus shutting down, animal rights activists have another industry in their sights.
Hollywood has had a very long and very rough history with animals. It dates back to old westerns. It goes through war films.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Animals on screen next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, Sean Flynn, managing editor of Spectrum News Charlotte, better known to many as News 14, and Andos Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And we're talking about the meeting that happened this week in advance of next Wednesday's meeting, where the school board will vote on this new assignment plan. And the board did look at a revision suggested by Dilworth Elementary parents about that pairing of Dilworth with
Sedgefield.
Thank you. What were they suggesting?
Well, again, it was not 100% clear what the board was suggesting. The parents, there's been a fairly large coalition that is saying this could be made to work if we rebalance the middle schools. If right now you have Sedgefield that is low socioeconomic status, predominantly lower performing, not perceived as a desirable assignment, and Alexander Graham, which is the opposite, very desirable.
Right.
And some of these neighborhood and family groups have suggested, and that was where that whole thing about throw another elementary school into the mix came from.
Yeah.
What Ann Clark said afterward, again, not in this public meeting to help clarify, but when we asked, she said, oh, yeah, that's Eastover. And they wouldn't be talking about the elementary school. They'd be talking about that zone being reassigned as part of this middle school balance.
And evidently not all of the parents who are reacting to this plan and finding out more about this plan are negative or even obstructive about it. Some are being helpful and cooperative. Eric Davis, a school board member whose district falls in the area of two other paired schools, Cotswold and Billingsville, praised the way that area has rallied around the idea of one school on two campuses. So we have groups of parents working not only to accept the changes but to make them work, and others, those impacted by the Moorhead STEM decision, for instance, who vigorously protested the move, at least according to school board member Ruby Jones, who you referenced a moment ago. And she wanted to know why Superintendent Ann Clark was sticking with the plan. Was there an answer?
Not a very clear one. And my sense, again, is that basically what Ann was saying was that they're going to go back, they're going to keep talking with school board members. Essentially, they haven't landed on anything. So what you have, and we were talking about this during the break, is board members making brief comments that are being watched and listened to by people who have a whole lot vested in this, and in some cases trying to figure out, what did this mean? You know, and I think this means something really bad, and so I'm really upset about it. It's not always easy to tell if the message sent is the message received.
Meanwhile, State Republican Senator Scott Stone, who's from here, who ran for mayor several years ago, has called for the board to delay voting on the plan because he wants to wait for Clayton Wilcox. He's the new superintendent who's already in town working on a pro bono, or not a pro bono, but on a per diem basis.
Yes.
And he starts the job July 1st. But Wilcox doesn't want the board to wait on the vote. And Stone also said it appears that Ann Clark is engaged in legacy building and that the board needs to back away from social engineering or else. He says riling lawmakers in Raleigh could have consequences.
Well, and we talked about this hot war between Raleigh and Charlotte, and if there are enough legislators who say, you know, we don't like what they're doing with student assignment, you might see things like, well, we've already seen the bill that would provide Matthews and Mint Hill the right to create their own charter schools. It's not clear totally what that or else might be, but he was not just saying, hey, I'm a CMS parent and I happen to have an opinion. He was saying, I am a legislator who's on the education committee and I have an opinion and you'd better listen to it.
Yeah, he's also characterized this plan as snow globe management. He said that you're shaking it up but not fixing the problem. The goal of this plan was to break up extreme pockets of poverty, and we've already talked about this on this program, and you've said many times that it doesn't really accomplish that. So is Scott Stone right?
Well, a goal of this plan was to break up concentrations of poverty, and there are people who say at least this is establishing some ground rules that will help us inch toward that goal. And then you have people like Scott Stone saying, you don't even need to start down this road. You need to turn around and back off of that road. You had Eric Davis at this meeting said that what we have seen from all of this is that we have essentially reached the end of a time when we can use student assignment to try to improve academic prospects. And I don't know, again, whether people – that's part of this dynamic, and I didn't answer you well about the racial dynamics. I would say that the board members who have been most skeptical about this are Erica Ella Stewart, Ruby Jones, Thelma Byers-Bailey, and Mary McRae, the board chair who's been a little less vocal. But I think you could see at Tuesday's meeting if they all feel like it's the diversity efforts that are losing, it's the black community that's losing, it's the kids who are consigned to these high-poverty schools – that we're essentially saying, eh, we've done all we can do, you could see some splits on some of these fairly controversial things. And I think that's the last thing that anybody wants is to go into this with a feeling that the white board members won and the black board members lost, because that does not position the board and Clayton Wilcox to move forward, which is essentially what everybody's hoping for at this point.
We are still fighting battles in the state because of the ordinance that Charlotte passed that led to HB2 and then the repeal of HB2 and the passage of the new law. And now on Tuesday, Governor Roy Cooper said he will soon announce an executive order addressing protections for the LGBT community. He made that announcement not in North Carolina, but in Washington. Why?
Well, he was invited to speak at a progressive group, and if you look through the list of speakers that he was there with, it's basically a presumed, we won't call it a short list, we'll call it a medium-sized list of potential Democratic nominees for president in 2020, which makes at least me wonder if he's raising his profile, if perhaps he would be want to be considered as, you know, something on a ticket, not necessarily the top of the ticket, but at least raising his profile. And he said that he promised, you know, Roy Cooper talked about how the repeal, yes, there were lots of problems with it, but he had to do something. He had to do compromise. And he basically came out with a statement saying he will issue some executive order at a future date which will expand LGBT protections in North Carolina. But that's an executive order. It's not clear what he can really do with that. If you look at the repeal bill, which he signed into law, the General Assembly is given the sole authority on the most controversial aspect of HB2, which is deciding who can use which bathrooms. That is given solely to the General Assembly in that law, stated very clearly. Now, Governor Cooper, obviously a longtime lawyer, he's very good at figuring ways to do things where it seems like you probably can't. But I don't see with an executive order how this can go much farther than, frankly, similar protections that were given by Governor Pat McCrory when he first tried to kind of roll back some of the controversy over HB2 and passed his own executive order that allowed state employees to use the restroom they choose.
Mm-hmm. And immediately upon making this announcement, he was pounced on by both sides. Tammy Fitzgerald, executive director of the NC Values Coalition, said that the governor had declared war on privacy protections for women and children in bathrooms, locker rooms, and showers. And Chris Groh, executive director of Equality NC, tweeted his continued refusal, meaning the governor, his continued refusal to take responsibility for negative consequences on LGBT community of the bill he signed is disheartening. He can't win for losing.
Well, and in fairness, both Chris Groh and Tammy Fitzgerald were against the repeal bill and or the compromise bill, depending on how you want to state it. I mean, this is something that I think this is one of the reasons that Governor Cooper is looking to try to do something. Mm-hmm. Because right now, both sides see him as doing the wrong thing with the bill. And he's taken a lot more heat than the General Assembly has for passing the bills in the first place. So I also believe that he does himself believe this, that something needs to be done. But I think he's feeling pressure that he needs a headline. He needs something to say, I am indeed still moving forward with this. I have not stopped the fight.
I want to back up in the interest of shameless promotion and mention that Ann Clark, superintendent of schools, will be on this program on Wednesday. So we'll talk about a lot of this school stuff before the vote on Wednesday night. North Carolina, it continues to be the only state in the nation that still tries 16 and 17-year-olds as adults in adult courts and sends them to adult prisons. And this week, we took a step toward joining the other 49 states when a bill to end that practice overwhelmingly passed the House. It now goes to the Senate. They have their own version of this bill, a competing version. What kind of reception is it likely to get in that chamber?
I imagine it's going to be getting some. I mean, when you are the only state out of 50 that still has this law, and what you the headline that I think people read is that they just want to raise the age to 18 to try somebody as an adult. And what about all these 16, 17 year olds who are killing people? And well, you can still go after them as adults. You can petition to try them as an adult. I think this is just trying to get everybody North Carolina in par with the rest of the country. I think, you know, the Senate has normally been a little bit more conservative, but I think you'll start seeing some movement there.
The only difference seems to be the details of how they do it,
right,
not whether
exactly.
they do it. And the biggest difference, as I understand it, is that the House would include some nonviolent felonies in the category where these teens would now be tried as juveniles, mm-hmm. whereas the Senate is saying only misdemeanor cases. But either way, something's going to shift.
Absolutely. In fact, the North Carolina Senate loves to put policy in their budget. You know, bills that normally would be passed as standalone bills, like raise the age. And in fact, in their proposed budget that they've got out and just passed, there is the beginnings of the raise the age movement there. And you're absolutely right, Anna. It's not as expansive, but it is there. And I would be personally pretty surprised if this doesn't happen this before the General Assembly is done with this session.
And I think it's absolutely the right thing to do. I think we're seeing nationally that elected officials are starting to recognize that we can't incarcerate our way out of certain problems. And if you go back to the gang sweep that occurred earlier this week, a lot of these people, a lot of these gangbangers, they were initiated, indoctrinated in prison. Mm-hmm. Do we want to start throwing 15, 16, 17-year-olds in prison for long periods of time where they're going to be exposed to this and they're going to come out at some point unless they've committed some horrible crime, and they're going to be much better at doing whatever it was that got them there to begin with? We've got to figure out a way to start to rehabilitate and to make it easier for these people to come back and be a part of society again.
This is the big brouhaha that they'll talk a lot about during On Point in Washington with daily news coming out of the White House. Over
Can we say hourly? Let's be honest.
Over the firing of James Comey, possible obstruction of justice charges because the president allegedly asked James Comey if he could stop investigating Michael Flynn, the former security advisor. And it goes on and on and on. And it involves a lot of North Carolina lawmakers who are chiming in on all of this. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham has invited Comey to testify before the Senate, but now that probably isn't going to happen because the special prosecutor, Mueller, is going to pursue this as a criminal investigation.
Well, that's former FBI director, who is now the special counsel, right. Robert Mueller. That's not necessarily true. These two things don't have to be mutually exclusive. It will delay. Mm-hmm. It may, in fact, impede him going to testify, Comey going to testify before either, frankly, the House or the Senate, because he would not want to be seen as potentially interfering with a criminal investigation. But those two things don't have to be mutually exclusive.
And Lindsey Graham seems to be particularly hot on the trail of this. He and Senator John McCain seem to be vigorously involved in this.
And they are both two people who are not huge fans of President Donald Trump and never have been. Now, I'm not implying that there's some kind of political motivation there, but I think the person that's more interesting to watch here, and let's face it, this week it seems like the Watergate references are just going back and forth. I mean, you just can't seem to avoid them recently, right down to an odd photo op with the President of the United States sitting next to none other than Henry Kissinger in the Oval Office. But I think the real star here, potential star here, is North Carolina Senator Richard Burr,
yes.
And he's already being – given the fact that he is the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, he's already being compared, or people are beginning to wonder if he will be the same person throughout this investigation as Senator
Sam Ervin?
Sam Ervin was during Watergate itself.
But Ervin was a Democrat facing a Republican president, and that's the difference there, right? Because Richard Burr is a Republican and a Trump fan. He campaigned for him.
Well, I think it's a stretch to say he's a Trump fan. Let's not forget that he did not jump into the Trump train until it was clear he had the nomination. Okay. And then he did fully jump on that train. He was part of an advisory committee for the Trump campaign. He has stood by the president time and again.
But the statements he's made this week,
yep,
exactly, are showing that he's not fully on the Trump train anymore.
But when the fact that FBI Director James Comey wrote a memo to file over his conversations with the president, Richard Burr, who heads the Senate's Intelligence Committee, pushed back on that because he said somebody's going to have to do more than just have anonymous sources in the New York Times on this one for me to believe that there's something there, because he's talked to James Comey, and James Comey never brought this up, and he used to share a lot of information. He never shared that as a piece of information.
That doesn't surprise me so much, actually. In any big investigation, you don't necessarily stop and go after the first violation you see if you're investigating something larger. So it doesn't surprise me so much that Comey did not stop in the middle of this investigation to raise a fuss over this.
I totally agree with you on this. And for a simple reason, just like with the whether or not Comey will testify before Congress, if in fact it is what the New York Times has reported it is in terms of this memo, and if in fact Comey believed it may have been obstruction of justice, that's a potential criminal investigation. And we do now know from a closed-door meeting with Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein, mm-hmm, that the special counsel looks to be a criminal investigation. That, again, is according to Lindsey Graham.
So there'll be more on this coming up on Point with Tom Jelton, who's guest hosting today. And, of course, we're doing an entire hour on this with political scientist and a former Charlotte City Council member who had a front row seat to Watergate. That will be Monday on this program at 9. My thanks to Sean Flynn, managing editor of Spectrum News Charlotte, Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and, Tom Bullock with WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.